Welcome, everyone, to the Take Control of Your Health podcast. This is Dr. Mercola bringing you the latest cutting-edge interviews to help you achieve optimal health. You can receive more information by subscribing to my free daily newsletter at mercola.com. Thank you so much for listening. So let's get started with this week's latest program to help you and your family take control of your health. Welcome, everyone. Dr. Mercola helping you take control of your health. And today we are joined by a favorite, certainly a favorite of mine, Georgia Dinkoff. He's been gracious enough to dialogue with me and help me understand a lot of the great late Ray Peet's work. Now, Georgie, I've got a question for you. About 18 months ago, two events happened, significant events, that were really, well, one event was sad, the other was world-changing. Do you have an idea? It was an interesting coincidence.
Well, one of them was Ray Peet passed away. I'm guessing
yes,
that's one
that
of them.
Yes, that was one. How about the other one? And it's in your field. That's a hint.
The one that I was going to mention is basically the war in Ukraine. But it's about a year now, so it's not 18 months. I guess something else happened.
Yeah, something. It's in your field. That's the hint.
Something hacking-wise?
No, it was the introduction of ChatGPT.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. For the AI thing. Well, you know,
I was just looking at the date when Ray passed, and it was literally within a week of when ChatGPT was launched.
Yeah, I guess it is a monumental change for a lot of people. I just haven't used it in my field yet, so I guess that's why I haven't
considered. That's a whole other discussion we should have, for sure, because it's the potential for that is beyond enormous. But that's a topic for another discussion. And it would be good to have you back, because many people aren't aware that you are an amazing programmer and coder, and you are employed, have several government contracts. You know, that's your primary source of revenue. It's not doing podcasts.
That's right.
You're a brilliant programmer. Brilliant. You've brought most everything you put your mind to. So we got a lot of things to talk, and I want to talk about some of your mouse research, but there's two topics I want to discuss first that I think you'll delight in. First of all, I want to extend my deep gratitude for your help in mentoring me and understanding and applying Ray's work. There's never been a body of work that I've encountered in medicine that took me longer to comprehend and understand and then improve it. It took me almost a full 18 months, because the breadth of his work is just enormous. The complexity, it's relatively simple, but there's a lot of details to it, and it's a lot of moving parts. And so don't feel bad if you hear this information, you're confused, because it took me literally a year and a half to get it where I really fully understand it and grasp it. And then there's still many pieces that don't make sense. And
a great quote from Ray, she said, ideally, the world should never make sense until the right knowledge and the right circumstances will flip a switch, and then it makes sense. Yeah.
So what I'm really excited about, because I have not had an opportunity to discuss with you, but within the last month or so, maybe 2 months, I've understood something that Ray didn't. And he understood most of the stuff about health, but he missed this. And I'm not sure why, but he did. And I'm really excited to share this with you. And it was really one of the aspects of his approach that I had some concerns about. And that is this ostensible anomaly where, and many people sort of pervert and really change his information to suit their own needs. But there's a belief that many people have that he advocated large amounts of sugar, and that sugar, you could have sugar endlessly and you'd be fine. And that's not the case at all. Yeah. Sugar itself is okay. If it's refined, it's more of a problem. But if you use it, increase is going to be, it's definitely a problem. So the issue really boils down to the microbiome. And I believe he didn't put a lot of emphasis on there. Certainly he talked about endotoxin and such, but I don't think he had a full deep appreciation of the power of the microbiome. It may be the single most influence on health. Because listen, they outnumber us like a lot, like
10 to 1 or something.
Yeah. 10 to 1, yes. Yeah. 10 micro. Well, that's just the microbes. I don't even talk about the bacteriophages, which is another 10 to 1, 100 to 1. You know? So it's probably more. And we have no concept of the influence of these bacteriophages, you know, let alone know identify them. So anyway, just to simplify it, the contention was, and many people in the PEET community believe that it's wise to avoid starch and have lots of fruit. Fruit would be the ultimate carbohydrate. And I believe that's true, and it was Ray's experience, but it was only the experience because metabolism was trashed. The vast majority of the population, I believe it's comparable to those who are metabolically inflexible, which at this point, I mean, the most current published data we have relates to NHANES data published, I think, in 2023 was 2018 data. So they're probably getting ready to publish the update to that, but still 6 years old, And it was 93.1%. So that number now is probably 96 to 97% of the population is metabolically inflexible. And I contend is also mitochondrially dysfunctional or mitochondrially impaired. And if you don't have enough mitochondria, you can't create cellular energy, at least efficiently or in an abundance that is required to do a really, really important function that I don't think Pete understood. I'm pretty confident he did not. And it's still pervasive in the community. So what is that function? That function is absolute requirement to get an optimal microbiome. If you're not creating cellular energy, you're not going to have a healthy microbiome. It just doesn't work. So 97% of people are not creating enough cellular energy. So their microbiome is messed up. So by definition, many of them are going to have problems with starch and vegetables and all ostensibly really healthy things. When we were making enough energy, they weren't problems. They were health foods. Now, because we're impaired, they become problematic. And why are they problematic? Because there's basically two different types of bacteria in the gut. One of them is the beneficial bacteria, and the other are the pathogenic. There's a lot of substance, but that, if you break down to two camps, the beneficial bacteria, they both are gram-negatives, primarily gram-negatives, but you can divide those into two other camps. One would be obligate anaerobes. These are bacteria that just are destroyed with a molecule of oxygen. Those are the good guys. And within the cell walls of the good guys, and this is not widely known, there's no lipopolysaccharide. There is no endotoxin. You can feed those guys so the cows come home and you'll just get healthy because they make good things like short-chain fatty acids, butyric acid, propionic acid, glucagon-like peptide, or glucagon itself. I think they create glucagon. Not the glucagon-like, no, GLP-1 is what they make. So GLP-1. So, and then you've got the facultative anaerobes, the ones that tolerate oxygen. And I'm almost done, and I'll let you comment on it. But what happened is if you're not making enough energy, it requires energy to exclude oxygen from the large intestine. And that's where 99% of your microbes in your gut are. They're in your large intestine. That you have them in almost all the other places. And if they're in large numbers, in like the small intestine, then you have SIBO. But they're supposed to be mostly in your large intestine. So when there's not enough cellular energy, oxygen's leaking in, you're killing the good guys. The primary one here is Akkermansia. It should be about 10% of the population of your bowel. And in many cases, and I've been talking with some of the companies that do the measurement, where they actually do this DNA analysis and they find out exactly what species are there. And Akkermansia was not even identified until 20 years ago. Yeah, in ideal cases, it should comprise about 10% of your microbiome. 10%. And one out of three people, these companies that measure it, they find it's not present. They can't detect it. It's not there. They're so messed up. That's 30. And what about I'm going to do some deep dives in this and really get the data. We're going to actually probably purchase some of this equipment and start doing testing on it too. But the point here is that when you don't have enough cellular energy, the oxygen leaks in, you get these facultative anaerobes. These are the pathogenic bacteria, and they have endotoxin in their cell walls. And that's the problem. And so when you feed starch and you have a preponderance of these pathogenic bacteria, you have problems. And you really don't have another solution. So many people, the only type of carb that they're going to tolerate well and not produce this endotoxin is the fruit juice. Yep. That's it. That's all they can tolerate. Anything else, they're going to have a problem. They will trigger diseases. Sure. So I think the key here, and there's a number of different ways we can explore about how to improve mitochondrial energy, but ultimately that's it. You got to increase mitochondrial energy. And there's other things you can do to improve that. But once your gut microbiome is healthy, then you're in a different camp. Then the starch becomes healthier. And it actually is, I think, much healthier than fruit. Because I think, you know, the Pete community has been disparaging Lustig and Robert Lustig and Rick Johnson for their work on fructose. But I think there's some truth into their work. Yeah, I really do. I think there's some confusion, and it's not as bad as they portray it to be, and they don't really acknowledge that fruit can be healthy. But I think ultimately the fructose complicates the metabolism, and it's acceptable, but it's not ideal. And I think that you should have some, because there's really what fruit does have, not so much for the fructose, it has magnificent polyphenols. And yep. A lot of the starches don't. I mean, the polyphenols in fruit are just out through the roof. And those polyphenols are very beneficial for the gut microflora. And they tend not to activate the gram positives or the pathogenic bacteria. They're relatively neutral. So you get some benefit there. So anyway, that is what I've uncovered. And I don't, there are other people who have done it. One of my friends, Ashley Armstrong, and I kind of reached this conclusion just recently, and she's cut and covered some literature, and I can send you a study that kind of does this. But I'm wondering, that's the thesis. That's what I've, not the thesis, but I think that the information that I've come to identify as sort of the missing piece in Ray's work. He didn't get this. He didn't understand it. And this is the next level. And I you know, it's sad that he's not alive, that we can't discuss it with, because I'm pretty confident he would agree with it.
Yeah, I think so. And also some things that weren't as predominant while he was alive is that recently the food industry started adding a lot of antibiotics to the food just as a preservative. There's something called, I think, Nisin, and they're putting it into cheeses, any kind of cooked food you buy from, even from supposedly healthy places like Whole Foods. So we're ingesting a lot of actually industrial antibiotics on a regular basis if we're eating processed foods. So those antibiotics, of course, they're going to mess up the microbiome. And it just so happens that the facultative anaerobes that you mentioned, they're opportunistic bacteria. And they can, once the microbiome count declines, when you stop intaking the antibiotic, the bacterial count of the pathogenic bacteria rises much more quickly. So if you're taking antibiotics on a periodic basis and allowing them the microbiome to recover, over time, you're going to end up with predominantly pathogenic makeup. Which may be why some of the older studies demonstrated that eating the lactobacillus strains, if you have already a messed up microbiome, may be beneficial. Mm-hmm. Another thing directly related to the production of energy is that multiple studies have demonstrated that if the intestinal barrier is intact, which almost entirely depends on oxidative phosphorylation and production of ATP, then it largely does not matter what kind of bacteria you have. But even if it's mildly compromised, then basically you're getting bacterial fragments coming into the bloodstream. And then it just so happens that the more compromised the gut barrier is, the more of the pathogenic fragments you're allowing in without actually absorbing the beneficial products such as the short-chain fatty acids. Mm-hmm. So basically how much the microbiome will affect you negatively depends largely on the intestinal barrier, which depends almost entirely on the production of energy. So even if you have a very messed up microbiome, you can still be largely okay if you're producing sufficient amounts of energy. But since a lot of these pathogenic bacteria are also producing endotoxin, even if your colon is okay, or in general the gastrointestinal tract, including the small intestine, even if they're fine, over time the exposure to endotoxin is going to interfere with that barrier.
No question. Endotoxin is the devil. There's no question. I think there's three things that largely contribute to cancer. It's endotoxin, estrogen, and linoleic acid. Those are the three. Those are the three big ones, for sure. But I want to comment on two points. The antibiotics you mentioned, that was another contention I had with the Ray Peake community, is that they would actually advocate the use of antibiotics to kill for the treatment of gut. Now, admittedly, they tended to focus and concentrate on ones that were less challenging, like the tetracycline family. But still, they're antibiotics. And I think that's a last-ditch resort. And I'm not disputing the fact that many people did get improvement, but it's not the solution. You don't go in and kill these things. You need to restructure that. And the other important point about the intestinal barrier I want to mention, it's really important. I mentioned acromantia. Are you familiar with acromantia? Have you heard of it before?
I know it's one of the species that's there. Okay. That basically it's supposed to be good for us.
You know what its last name is?
No.
Well, there are many different species, but the primary one is mucinophilia.
Also,
so the first name is mucin. It produces most of the mucin in your gut. And guess, you're talking about leaky gut. You could have holes punched in there, but if you have mucin covering over like this giant Band-Aid, You don't have a breach in the barrier. You can have the holes, but it's plugging it up. It's like I don't know. It's like a patch, a rubber patch on a tire. You know, that you get a leak, it'll patch it for you. And when you this acromantia is gone, you have big problems. And you're right. You get leaky gut because you don't have enough mucin. And even though, because there's two separate issues going on, and I don't think they're looked at independently. You've got the mucin layer, and then you've got the holes, two separate things. And the mucin will compensate for some of those until your body's able to repair it, assuming you get enough cellular energy to heal up those holes. Because ultimately you want to. But it would make sense that your body has a rescue mode. It has like a repair kit, right? Why wouldn't
of course,
it never
it's not trying to kill. Yeah, that's the whole point of like cancer is not an attempt to kill. It's an attempt to fix something. But without sufficient energy, you get a substandard fixing and ultimately kills you because it's just not fixed properly.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the key. And I think the fundamental solution is to increase your cellular energy. I don't think you can do anything until you have optimized cellular energy production.
That I agree.
Is the core. And that's what Ray Keith, that's his life work. That's why he called it bioenergetic medicine. And he was the single best leader in understanding that and bringing that work to life. So great kudos to him for doing that.
Intestinal motility also almost entirely dependent on metabolic rate. One of the old diagnostic criteria for hypothyroidism was how often you go to the bathroom, right? Mm-hmm. And apparently it used to be normal to go after almost every meal. Not after every meal, but also almost every meal.
Three, four
and if you do now, I think normal is basically once a day. And even if you go once every 2 days, the doctor is not necessarily worried. I mean, my kids, sometimes they're constipated. We call the doctor and they said, well, if it continues for a week, then give me a call. And I thought, a week? We could get like poisoning, you know, if you don't go to the bathroom for a week. But that's the currently accepted level of optimal motility. Yeah. I think it should be at least once a day. I mean, like maybe twice is probably optimal. And it's also they have the composition of the stool. I mean, whether you're dehydrated and basically like whether you have fermentative colon as they're calling it. I think the companies that are doing the microbiome analysis out there can give you a pretty good idea of what's going on in your colon, which will largely reflect your metabolic rate as well. So if you're not going to the bathroom very often, and if you're going too often for urination, those are two very good signs of low metabolic rate. Too much urination, not enough excretion of fecal matter.
I agree. I think that it's really so. Remember, I'm opening this up with saying the importance of the microbiome, and I have had a really good idea. The problem with these microbiome tests, they're typically aren't covered by insurance, and the least expensive one you can find is about $500. $500, and they go up to $1,000, and they all use the same piece of equipment. It's this DNA sequencer or RNA, but made by a company called Illumina. They control the market. I control it, but they've captured the market for whatever reason. Probably they're doing a really good job. So I contacted three of the largest companies that test microbiome. Talked to their chiefs of people, if not their CEO or founder, and I had a good idea. I said, listen. People need this test. It's going to be absolutely essential. Why don't we do something? We'll promote your test for free. We won't take any money for it. We'll just promote it, but we got to sell it for $50. You know, so that was my goal to do it. And I got one company to agree to it. Then they backed out on it. So the other company said no. So I'm opening up you don't know this yet, but I'm opening up a clinic system real soon.
Excellent.
Certainly it's going to start in my clinic in South Florida and it's going to be extended throughout the country eventually. And we're going to be testing for this. So I'm actually in the process of negotiating rates for getting this equipment. So we're going to be testing your microbiome and we're going to have the test for $50. So that you can screen it. Now it's not going to be the same test that they're selling for $500,000. It's going to be six keystone species. But for most people, almost every one of those tests, Georgie, they're focused on disease, just like the conventional medical model. They're looking for the pathogenic bacteria. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, if you've got someone who's dying from you, because the only reason they're doing that is to try to find an antibiotic to kill it. That's not the way you treat this problem. That is not the way you optimize your microbiome, by finding out the bad guys are and trying to shoot them. No, you find out how many good guys you have and do everything you can to make those good guys return. Yep. Once the good guys return, there's a process or a process. There's a aspect of in microbiome. It's not an aspect either. It's a characteristic. it's a feature of microbiology, something called competitive inhibition. So that when you have the good guys present, right, they crowd out all the bad guys. They can't exist because the good guys will win if you give them the environmental circumstances to survive. And that's the goal. And you only need to test about six, and you can do that much less expensively. So that's my goal, is to just test for the good guys. And if people wanted to test for them as they can, we'll offer that test for them. And that actually helps subsidize the test, because at $50, you're charging less than it costs to do the test, you know? So, but we want to get it almost free for people to test, so they know they have this problem. Because as I said, I talked to these companies, and one out of three of these people don't have any acromantia. That's probably the single largest keystone species. And at some point in the very new future, it doesn't really exist now. There's one company that innovated this, but they don't really have good quality strains of acromantia. It doesn't really exist commercially well in the world. We're getting close. There probably will be later this year that they're coming out. We'll be one of the first companies to offer them. But you can actually, just like you have a garden, they have beautiful, lush garden, all these beautiful vegetables and fruits and stuff, but they died. You know, well, you got to replant the seeds. Same thing. You got to replant the acromantia, and then you have the good environmental conditions, and they grow back, and you're back.
Or they get choked by weeds if the weeds grow too much, right?
That's
they
exactly compete. What it is. That's a very good analogy, because those pathogenic bacteria are the weeds. And you can just think it's your lawn. When it's overgrown by weeds, the good grass dies. It's exact same process, competitive inhibition in the grass. Yep. The lawn.
Limited amount of resources, and then whichever species takes you know, prevalence, then they usually, you know, stick around. The others are suppressed.
Now, I want to dive into one of Ray's other recommendations that I don't think he recommended enough. He certainly understood it. And I've heard him speak many times and read many of his newsletters that discuss this. And that is the value of collagen, or he typically referred to as gelatin. Now, gelatin, I think, is an inferior form of collagen. Ultimately, it's collagen. That's the protein. And most people, most professionals, you ask them, what is the most common protein in the body? Virtually no one answers that question correctly. Virtually no one.
Should be collagen because it's 30% of your bones and it's 60% of your skin.
30% of the protein in your body.
Yeah.
And I've got a good dearest friend who we're hiring to work in my company. And his passion for the last at least dozen years or so has been osteoporosis and has been actively involved in screening programs, therapies to improve it. And I asked him what he thought was the single most important nutrient to build up bone density. He didn't know. It's collagen. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't it be? If you don't, 30% of your bone is collagen. 30%. Yeah. And it's interesting. If you look at the microarchitecture and muscles too, I mean, even your muscle fibers, your muscle is composed of lots of collagen. It's seamless. I mean, the tendons and the ligaments, they merge into the muscle. They're part of it. It's just the same structure. In fact, around every one of the sarcomeres is collagen. You can't have muscle without collagen. It doesn't work without collagen. Yep. It's the most fundamental protein in your body, I think, you know, and Ray understood that. He regularly encouraged, I mean, when you hear him on his radio show podcast, he was always telling people to take gelatin. He would say gelatin, but it's the same thing, collagen.
It's just gelatin just hydrolyzed collagen. So it just creates jello when you mix it with water. Collagen will not, but it still has the same benefits because when you ingest it, it'll get hydrolyzed by the stomach acid and the other
proteases. Yeah, I think collagen is a little better because it's less purified. It's less processed.
Yes, longer chain peptides, which you know, and tend to have more beneficial effects.
Yeah, I haven't studied it. You probably have read the literature on it, but my guess is that these peptides are biologically active. It's not just the constituent amino acids that serve as building blocks, but these actual collagen peptides, which is a peptide is just a series of a string of amino acids. It's not a full protein, but these peptides are bioactive. Would you agree?
I can give a direct example. Several studies demonstrated that if you ingest collagen with a very large amount of glucose, it doesn't trigger nearly the same insulinogenic response because the collagen can fill in for a lot of the insulin. Some of the peptides are very similar in structure. So it's like you're ingesting insulin and you don't have to trigger your pancreas to produce as much. So it improves directly your insulin sensitivity with every meal.
And this is why I think almost anyone who's doing carnivore is seriously serious, confused, and mistaken. Do I think that animal protein it shouldn't be used? And heck no, I think it's wonderful. I think you will never be optimally healthy without it. But to focus exclusively on muscle meat is a serious mistake. It's a profoundly serious, and will accelerate your demise. There's no question. You cannot be optimally healthy without collagen. It's like physically impossible.
I agree. And but if you're eating the burgers that sell in most of the stores, because they're made with some of the cheaper cuts, which include a lot of collagen,
or hot,
you probably be doing okay. Don't eat filet mignon. Filet mignon is very expensive and very bad for you. Go for the skirt steak or for the burgers that include a lot of collagen, because they have in the effort to keep the price low for production, they're including more collagen than we would like.
It's a cheaper form. Exactly. Yeah, and they try to get rid of it, but they don't realize they're compromising what they perceive, what the average person would see as compromising the quality, actually turns out to be a really good thing, really good thing. Yeah, because that's where they put the good parts in and you get them. So if you were to think about it and make a recommendation for collagen, since I think we've made a pretty solid argument that it's foolish. Well, let me just extend the reasons why it's foolish, because it doesn't have the three amino acids. You know, there's 20 amino acids, and some of them are considered essential.
Yep.
But the primary amino acids in collagen are, well, there's a few points here, but are glycine, proline, and hydroxyproline.
Yep.
And there are others, of course. But it's not so much what the amino acids are, what amino acids aren't there. And you've said this many times on your podcast and interviews, but the things would be tryptophan, cysteine, and methionine. They are in very, very low qualities, almost non-existent in collagen. They're just not there.
And tryptophan is the only one, despite being essential, that in large amounts is directly carcinogenic. It's the only amino acid that can do that.
Now, here's an anomaly, because I've got some really interesting things I can't wait to share with you. But cheese, I was shocked, has a high amount of tryptophan, significantly more than egg whites. I thought egg whites was the highest source, but I think it might be cheese. But somehow, in some way, and I don't know, I think it's somehow buffering the impact of tryptophan. But cheese is a health food. There's in certain circumstances, and I'll expand on that in a moment. But assuming that you have the healthy cheese, which I believe is one of the healthiest foods on the planet, is cheese. And I'll expand on some of the reasons for that. But why do you think the high tryptophan in cheese is detrimental?
So something about the casein protein, which cheese is 100% casein if it's properly made, the whey has been completely removed. Casein has been shown in multiple studies to have a direct anti-stress effect. And because it has a high content of the branched-chain amino acids as well, they compete for absorption from the gastrointestinal tract with tryptophan. I think I mentioned it in one of the podcasts. So you ingest a lot of tryptophan, but you're not absorbing
that. It's a tryptophan blocker.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't know that. That makes perfect sense.
So is the calcium.
It's not a buffer. It's a blocker.
Yeah. Calcium and the branch chain. Yeah.
Wow. And it buffers the branch chains from coming in, because we know. Yeah. I mean, the community, but the health community has a misperception of the value of branch chain amino acids and even take it as a supplement. Well, that probably is not a good idea.
Yeah. The branch chains are
problematic.
If you only take them, they outcompete both tyrosine, the aromatic amino acids, which are L-tyrosine, phenylalanine, and tryptophan. Yeah. So this means they will deplete because there's something called the blood-brain barrier, and the branched-chain amino acids compete with the other three amino acids for uptake into the brain. So if you're only taking the branched-chain amino acids in large doses, you're going to deplete both tyrosine and tryptophan in the brain, which means both your serotonin and dopamine levels will drop. But if you take the branched-chain amino acids with L-tyrosine or phenylalanine, it will deplete tryptophan and thus serotonin, but dopamine levels will rise. In fact, there is a study with mice showing that you can abolish the so-called central fatigue due to exhaustive exercise without giving any calories. Well, the amino acids have a few calories, but giving basically a few grams, the equivalent of a few grams of branched-chain amino acids and 1 or 2 grams of L-tyrosine, which shows you that most of the fatigue that we perceive, it's not due to energy depletion, it's due to accumulation of serotonin in the brain. Branched-chain amino acids have that effect. So in the brain and also in the gut. So if you're consuming L-tryptophan, methionine, or cysteine, consuming them with foods that contain a decent amount of the branched-chain amino acids or calcium, or aspirin. Aspirin is another.
Or cheese,
exactly. That's the natural way. Yeah. Well, the phenolic molecules are very widely present in nature. So if you're consuming a lot of fruit, which contains many of those phenolic molecules like salicylic acid and some of its analogs, those also have a direct inhibiting effect on the absorption of all three of the inflammatory amino acids from food.
Now, I'm going to make a relatively outrageous statement, and I suspect you know the answer, but you may not. I think you do. I contend that 90% of cheese is not a health food. In fact, it's very dangerous for you. And obviously, if it's processed, it's going to be. But I'm assuming even if it's whole milk, non-pasteurized, biodynamic Amish milk, why is it not good for you? What is the reason it makes most cheese is not healthy for humans?
Well, the ones that are sold in the stores, they use vegetable kind of rennet and
okay, that's it. I knew you knew it. Okay. They call it. Listen, it is not vegetable rennet. It's synthetic rennet.
Synthetic. I'm sorry. Yeah, I wanted to say it's made in the lab. Yeah, a GMO
it's
too.
GMO is GMO rennet. Yeah. Guess you know the company that makes this and sells it?
Monsanto probably. Monsanto Pfizer, or one of its bad. Pfizer. Pfizer. There you go.
Pfizer. Yeah, and they started in the late 90s. I got to tell you an interesting story. I did not grow up eating healthy, and my mom, I loved her to pieces. She loved me, and is largely responsible for most of the beneficial things I've been able to do in life because of her unconditional love. But she didn't know any better, and she gave us desserts after every meal, and it wasn't healthy desserts, but she thought she was helping us. You know, she's doing a loving thing in her mind. And I would say more than half of my teeth had mercury amalgams by the time I was in high school. I was loaded with mercury amalgams. So I had to get them removed. By the time I could afford it and was in medical school and make it earning a living, as soon as I found out it was dangerous, I went out and had them all removed. And the guy I saw was well-intentioned, but it was not a biological dentist. He didn't know, no idea, no precautions were taken. And he damaged my kidneys to the point where they're a problem. I mean, potentially, if I went on checked, I could have been on renal dialysis. Because mercury is a nephrotoxic. No question about it. It kills your kidney cells. But then it was like the mid-90s that happened. And about the same time, they introduced this synthetic rennet. I had no idea it was an issue. And I love cheese. So, and I noticed I'm assiduous and I was taking my blood test all the time. Like usually at least once a month, sometimes twice a month. I do it twice a month now. And I would notice that anytime I had cheese, my kidney function would destroy it. I'm going to go, creatinine should be like about 1.1. If it goes up into the high ones, twos, you're looking at pre-renal failure, you know, and a dialysis. It's a problem. So it doesn't take much to switch it. So I'd be get up to 1.4, 1.6, even 1.8, you know, which is a problem. But if I avoided cheese and I kept my protein lower, like 120 grams a day, then I can get by it and I can get it to the 1.1.1. Well, maybe 1.1 to 1.3. But I had to stay about 120 grams of protein, which I wanted to take more, but I couldn't because my kidneys couldn't tolerate it. So then Ashley Armstrong, and you know Ashley, right? I think, have you been on her podcast before?
Well, yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you know her well.
They've invited me. Yeah. The Strong Sisters, right?
The Strong Sisters. Yeah, yeah. They're both great. And so she told me about the animal rennet. Maybe I'd heard it in the past, but I ignored it and didn't think it was an issue. And she actually produces cheeses too. So she sent me some and I loved it. And she said this animal. So I went crazy. My creatinine was 1.4 and I was at 120 grams. And I didn't know how much I just would love the cheese so much. I didn't even look at the protein. I was up to 180 grams of protein. I went up by 50%. It should have gotten my creatinine to 1.8, 1.9. I retested in 2 weeks later because I was having like a half a pound or more of cheese a day. I loved it. Wow. I just loved it. And as I said, before the test started, my creatinine was 1.4. It went down to 1.2.
While eating all this protein?
All the protein, yeah, and the cheese. Both of things would have destroyed my kidneys in the past. So obviously the rennet wasn't in there because she used animal rennet, which is what you need to do. And folks, do not ever buy cheese unless you can see on the label animal rennet. If it's not, just put your head down, think of a relative or a neighbor that you really don't like, and give them that cheese. Okay. Have at it.
Dr. Fauci. Nailed him.
Go for it. But don't eat it yourself or don't give it to anyone you love. So I wasn't getting the animal rennet. But what I come to realize is another principle that Pete advocated. Was it's the calcium to phosphorus ratio. Yeah. And Pete, and I heard him just recently on a podcast. I mean, obviously it was an old podcast, but when someone asked him how much calcium, he was eating 3 grams of calcium a day. 3 grams of calcium.
Yeah.
But his phosphorus level was half. And interestingly, I did an analysis in chronometer. I was the same way. My calcium was 3.3 grams and my phosphorus was 1.6. It's almost exactly 2-to-1. And phosphorus is a potent nephrotoxin, very potent.
And mitochondrial toxin directly.
I did not know that.
Dr. Saladino asked me for a reference. I found him. I can send him to you afterwards.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I did not realize. Inhibits. Yeah, phosphorus is a problem. But why does cheese work? Because the calcium in the cheese, as long as you have much more than the phosphorus, the extra calcium will bind the phosphorus and it's out in the urine or bound in the, maybe bound, it was bound in the stool probably, right?
Both. I mean, basically, it will prevent it from getting into the cell. And then the calcium itself activates pyruvate dehydrogenase. Yeah. So it's several of the Krebs cycle enzymes. So it's a directly pro-mitochondrial.
Well, you expand that too, because PDH, pyruvate dehydrogenase, that's the throttle control. That's you want everything you do to activate that enzyme and to do everything to stop the inhibitors of that, because that pushes it into glycolysis and that will give you less energy. Yep. Big time. Yeah. So I thought you'd enjoy that story.
I like that a lot. Yeah. I mean, basically, you guys are eating at the Maasai level amounts of calcium. I think they average between 3 and 5 grams a day, depending on how often they kill a cow, because for them, cows are the main source of food.
I advocated animal meat, and I was eating bison for many years, and I'd gradually cut it down to 3 ounces a day. In other words, it would take me a pound. I mean, 5 days to eat a pound. But once I got the cheese back on, I stopped the bison. I'm just eating cheese.
I think it's great. It's not just the calcium. The casein protein itself has some direct anti-aging effects. Do you know this guy, Shirali Muslimov, that the National Geographic did a movie about? There was a documentary done by National Geographic in the 70s. This guy is an Azeri guy who used to live in present-day Azerbaijan and lived to the ripe age of 168. Confirmed.
I might hit that someday.
Confirmed by official passport issued to him by the Tsar back during the Russian Empire. He got married at the age of 120. Had two children at the age of 128.
And you believe the records? It's not like...
National Geographic verified it. They went there. It wasn't a scam. I mean, we have to find that movie.
Send me that article. You got it? Send me that link. I got to look at that.
And the only reason he died is that at the age of 167, while riding a horse, fell off the horse and broke a major bone and just didn't recover. Otherwise, he was physically active and healthy.
He needed CO2. If you have high CO2 levels, you'll never break a bone unless you're like in a high speed motor vehicle crash with enormous forces.
But his diet was predominantly cheese and bread. That's what the article said about it. So that's what he was eating. It was a shepherd.
Okay, so now I want to go back to the collagen because I think there's great value here, and I want to explain. And it is collagen. I think you could use gelatin, and it's less expensive, but it's processed, and you're not going to get the value of these peptides, these collagen peptides that have great biological value. So what would you think is the best source of collagen?
So now it depends on the animal, because now lately they've been scaring us with avian flu, with mad cow disease. I guess porcine is probably like the least likely one to have any kind of a viral or bacterial contamination. But I would say the skin of the animal is probably the best source, and also the bones. Now the bones, like if you're dealing with bones, then if it's a cow and there's mad cow disease in the country, maybe a problem. But skin, even from a sick cow, is usually okay. So as long as it says that it's being produced predominantly from skin sources, then I think it's okay. Unfortunately, there's some companies out there that are making it from feathers, from horns, from hooves. Now all of these are collagenous tissues, obviously, but I've tried all of them. It's just that they're using them as a source because they're much cheaper. The Japanese company Ajinomoto, which is very famous for producing a number of different amino acid products, they're unfortunately most of them are made from feathers. So I've tried them. It doesn't affect me badly, but I wouldn't use it as a major source.
Well, let me offer you some insights from what I've learned. I recently got a dog. A great Pyrenees, beautiful animal, still a puppy, 6 months old, weighs 70 pounds at 6 months.
Wow.
And
a puppy.
Yeah. And I'm actually training him. He's got a lot through, gone through a lot of obedience training. I'm actually getting him to for protective therapy too, because these are great protectors. He will ultimately be about 150 pounds.
Are they shepherd dogs?
No, they're bigger than shepherds, but a type of shepherd. They're mountain shepherds.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but they're bigger than German shepherds for sure, quite a bit. So I'm trying to figure out the best bone for him, and I've learned through people who do this that there's a bone called the knuckle bone. Have you ever heard of that before?
No, okay, really.
Knuckle bone is the term the butchers use for a cow knee.
Oh, okay.
Can you imagine the connective tissue in a knee?
Yeah, a ton of cartilage.
Can you imagine any
cartilage.
Other joint? Maybe the elbow of the shoulder that has more connective tissue.
No, the shoulder, no, because there's a lot of meat around it, and it's just bare bone, actually. So yeah. So the knees,
like the cow, most connective tissue of anywhere in the animal. Would you agree? Yeah.
And ankles, if you can get ankle, but knees bigger.
Yeah, the knee is much bigger.
Yeah.
So I get like 40 or 50 knuckle bones and put them in. I put three of them in a pot and fill up the pot just to cover the water, so that all the bones are submerged. First of all, you cut off the fat, as much fat as you can, because you can't get the knuckle bones without fat. So you do that. And then if you look at the recipes, most of the recipes say to cook it for 72 hours and put some vinegar in. Well, you could do that, but that's a pain in the butt. Not many people. I mean, I first encountered bone broth is another way that you can is classified as. I first encountered that maybe 20 years ago. Probably 20 years ago. There was a neurologist who had an autistic child. Her name was Natasha McBride. No, it's Natasha Campbell McBride, and she had an autistic child. And she came. He had great improvements with this bone broth. And I tried it, and it was just a pain to make it for 72 hours. But then I realized we have a new innovation. It's called a pressure cooker.
Yep.
And you can pressure cook these bones for 2 to 4 hours. I say 2 hours if the bones are from a CAFO animal, where they could have lead and other heavy metals in the bone. So you don't want to cook them that long. And maybe that's the only bones you can get. But if you can get an organic grass-fed cow, then you cook them for 4 hours. 4 hours. Now, it's going to take longer than 4 hours because it takes time for that water to heat up. And that takes time for it to cool down. So it's probably closer to 6 hours, by the time you can take it out. And don't make the mistake of just saying that's the bone broth. No, because there's a lot of dissolved fat in there. So you want to let it cool down, go in the fridge and skim off all the fat. Because that fat isn't really good for you. You don't want a lot of fat. There's no reason you should have that fat. You want the collagen. That's the miracle there that you're going for. And then you got almost a magic broth. I don't think there's a finer collagen on the planet, truthfully.
Are you giving it to the dog, or is it for yourself or for both?
Oh, both. We share.
Both.
Right now, I'm about 185 and the dog is 70. So I'm more than double his weight, but I'm giving him still more than half of what I'm getting because, he's a grown boy.
Still a puppy? 7 months, right?
Closer to 6 months. He just had his birthday just a few days ago. Now I'll put a picture in here. He's just an adorable dog. I mean, he's so cute. I got him to guard my chickens because I had 50 chickens and 4 geese that were killed by predators. And I said, this is nonsense. The predators they're dead meat now. I'm going to have they're basically Great Pyrenees are a livestock guardian dog. They're called LGDs, and they're not just chickens, but goats, sheep, pretty much anything. They'll just destroy these predators.
What kind of predators are getting your chickens?
It's
Florida, right?
Foxes.
Oh, foxes. Okay.
They're
raccoons,
so
maybe raccoons. No.
No, it's mostly foxes. We got them on video recorder, but they're so fast you can't even see them on the video recorder. They're like lightning. These animals, they're crazy fast. Yeah.
Well, they're not faster than the dog. I guarantee you, he'll grab one and start
shaking. Well, and it's kind of like a car alarm in some words, because they're very sensitive to sounds and stuff, and they will sense them. And they'll start barking, and they're barking. If any predator has common sense, they'll run the other way. But some of them don't, then they're dead. Yeah. So anyway, so that's the bone broth, and then I combined. I was actually interviewing Brad Marshall. Have you heard Brad Marshall's work? Yeah. So he has this supposition of he believes starch is much healthier, and I think he's right. Just the starch. But the caveat is that you have to have a healthy microbiome. If you don't, then it's a problem. It's definitely a problem. But if you have a healthy microbiome and you use the starch, it does a lot of good things. It radically improves your health. So I basically, I make like 6 cups of rice. I mean, so I do 3 cups for, so I'm 6 cups of rice. We basically, between my dog and I, we have 3 cups of cooked rice a day. That's a lot of rice.
Yeah.
I think the cooked rice, it's
a couple hundred grams of carbs, basically, in that.
Yeah, yeah. Each of us have more than 1 pound a day of rice, cooked rice. So, and we cook, it's with the bone broth. And it's interesting. Yeah, I give my dog the option. They have no inherent bias, right? I put the cut meat with a little fat on it and the bone broth and the rice. Guess what food they eat first?
The bone broth.
Bone broth. Mm-hmm. No, I that's not complete because I do put an egg yolk or two in the rice. Yeah, that's the favorite food is egg yolk. So I think the egg bone broth, the rice, and the egg yolk is close to an optimal food. It's hard to think of a healthier meal.
Yeah, I mean, just the rice and the eggs probably are enough to give you like a complete meal. As long as it's
the only other thing on top of that is what I do for lunch is I throw in like, actually I do for breakfast too. I throw in, I'm up to 4 ounces of cheese each day. So I'm having half a pound of cheese. So
Of Ashley's cheese, not the commercial one, right?
No, animal rennet cheese. It doesn't have to be Ashley's, but don't eat any cheese unless it only has animal rennet. So that's the thing. Now, I got to tell you something that is really astonishing. To say it's astonishing is actually quite an understatement. We're starting these clinics, so I was getting some. I had to stock the clinic with good clinical equipment, and I was seeking to get a lean body mass analyzer. And there's some really interesting instruments out there that use bioimpedance. And I actually, in the early 90s, I did my first entrepreneurial venture outside of medicine was developing a handheld bioimpedance meter. I think I lost $500,000 on that, but it was an experiment. But I had a lot of interest in it. And now the technology is much better, for sure. And the leader in the field was InBody. And they correlate their data to DEXA scans. And I said, well, listen, I'm Dr. Mercola. I'm one of the biggest influencers in this space. Surely you can give me a good deal on your product. They're selling for $30,000. And they give me a minimal thing. They'd hardly budget it down. And they refused to listen to logic. I said, listen, if I like your device and I recommend it, people will really probably go toward it. And they said no. So that annoyed me so much that it forced me to look at the alternatives. And I'm so glad they were greedy. And they are greedy. They're greedy on steroids. I would never, ever, ever recommend an InBody to anyone. If you are using an InBody device, you need to have your head examined. Why? Because when I looked at it and did a deep dive in this, the alternatives, there's a company that doesn't correlate their data to DEXA. They correlate to MRI. And you probably know, because you're so smart, that MRI is a superior way to measure body fat than DEXA. And
DEXA mostly works for bones, and even there, it's only about 70% accurate.
DEXA is not good. And it's ionizing radiation. It's a lot of it. It's a lot of ionizing radiation. So and here's the other thing why you got to be absolutely irrational to ever choose InBody or any of the other ones, other than this company that does it, which is Seca, S-E-C-A. The Seca device costs 1/3 the price. 1/3. And it has a laser device at the top of it to measure your height. And they say, oh, that's nice. Well, it's a lot nicer than you think. Because all the other devices, they just tell you to input your height. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but the formulas they use, if you're off by 1/8 of an inch, you're going to get a significant measure in your body fat. Significant.
Because the height is squared. So basically, like even a tiny difference makes, you know, change makes a difference. Yeah.
Now I'm going to share with you the results of my bone broth cheese study. Anecdotal study of one, just me.
I love it.
Okay. So I did bone broth and the cheese. First of all, let's talk about my height. I was 6'1¼". I am now 6'3¼". I gained a half an inch in height. So clearly your epiphysis of your bones fuse at about 18. I did not.
Mostly under the influence of estrogen, I would like to emphasize.
Oh, I did not know that. Thank you for that refinement.
Several anecdotal reports, just as a tangent, people using aromatase inhibitors grow about an inch of height, even in adulthood.
Wow, that is beautiful. Thank you for sharing. That is just amazing. I did not know that. It makes sense, though. Yeah, estrogen's the devil. A lot of people give us a hard time for that. I remember the last time we talked about yeah. this. They're just, I don't care what they think. Cause
it's just, okay. They went away. They basically decided they lost the argument. It's not worth arguing. I never heard back from them. I did respond. Yeah. Never heard back.
Yeah. So, yeah, estrogen is a devil for sure. If you're taking estrogen, just stop it. Go listen to our old podcast on this. It's just, you want progesterone. That was what almost, I'm convinced, Georgie, that every single adult needs progesterone. Every single adult, not kids, but just adults. They'll benefit from it. I take progesterone every day. It's a cortisol blocker. It's an estrogen blocker. And it helps mitigate against some of the side effects of SSLA. So it's just crazy not to. And I'm writing a book on it. And some of the newer studies, it's a very powerful nervous system adjuvant. It really heals the nervous system. So if you have a neurological injury, it's crazy not to be on progesterone.
I'm sure you've seen the studies with TBI. They're using progesterone to recover from TBI.
No, I'm not surprised. I think I probably have some of them in my references. But anyway, so I gained a half an inch in height. But I was 8.5% body fat before I went into this. So having the cheese, the bone broth, and the rice, I gained 4 pounds.
Probably
muscle. From 181 to 185. My body fat went from 8.5% to 5.3%.
So there you go. So it was all muscle.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
Almost 85 pounds of muscle in my body, which is pretty high. I mean, it's over the 99th percentile. I'll put it that way.
There's also, they're saying the rumor over the age of 40, they're saying you can't get muscle unless you're using juice, quote unquote.
Yeah. Oh, that's baloney.
I know. Yeah. I agree.
And so though I didn't expand why I gained a half an inch. Explain. Right? So for those who don't, it's obvious if you understand health, but the difference comes from the height of your vertebral disc. And you have like 22 vertebrae, I think. I think that's it. Maybe it's more. I haven't looked at it for a while, but it's a lot. It's over 20. And they can get crushed with time. And and the bone broth actually facilitates, I believe, more connective tissue in there, and it causes increase in intracellular water. Because interesting, from the time I did this study, my intracellular water increased by half a liter.
You've added bone because it's the bone that can basically absorb a lot of that water and hold it.
Really? I didn't know. I didn't know it was the bone.
So wow. that kind of proves that you added bone, and that's what explains the height as well.
I did in a month. In a month.
No matter how much muscle you add, it's not going to increase your height, right? But if you add bone, especially on the vertebrae or the joints, then you're probably increasing height.
Yeah. So it shocked me. I wasn't expecting this to actually, I think I might be even taller was when I was 18. I don't know. It's hard to remember back then, but I know I was never 6'1". It's just under, but a half an inch at the age of 70 is just crazy. Now, do you remember ever reading any of Pete's material where he talked about people gaining height again?
So I know that when you wake up in the morning and you get up, you're supposed to be about a half an inch taller than at the time at night when you're going to bed, because over time during the day, basically all this weight and walking around compresses the spinal discs, right? Yeah. And then the joints also inflame, so you lose a little bit of height. But that difference, especially if it's maintained over time, it cannot be explained just by going to bed and waking up. So if you if you kept that height difference that you gained,
that's a good point, because there's great variability. So I've standardized the test. I take the test shortly after I get up in the morning. So it's always done at the same time of day. So the variables are minimized. And interestingly, just as a point, if someone's considering getting this type of testing done, you don't want to do it after you work out at all. You'll get spurious results. And it's because there's a shift from the water inside the cells to outside to extracellular water. And that will give you false results. So do not work out. I figured that out myself because I was measure myself. I would lose, I had a bowel movement or something. I theoretically should have less or more muscle mass because I have less weight. My weight would go down, but my body fat would go up. And it was because of the shift of intracellular water. And that's how this whole body impedance works. It measures your body water and the compartments that it's in. Yeah. And they also measure phase angle, which was pretty good. My phase angle went up a few tenths of a point. That would be extraordinary. Yeah.
Is this a device you'll be selling, or is this just a company that's selling it with a laser?
No, the laser comes with the product. It's not an add-on. Yeah, you just get it for free. Yeah. It's pretty cool though. Yeah. It's just, yeah. I mean, if you're looking down your weights, I mean, you have to look, just, you know, kind of standard is look straight ahead, not up like this or not down, just straight ahead. And that's the fair measure of your, but I mean, I'm still shocked, a half an inch. It's like crazy.
It's amazing. Yeah. Pete gained half an inch by using low doses of DHEA. I think
really?
In his 50s or 60s. Yeah, it's one of the articles.
Well, I do, based on your stuff, and I want to applaud you for you where you gave me the insights, you know, a year and a half ago. And I wasn't aware of this. I was listening to Dr. Jonathan Wright and thought the rectal suppository was the best way to go. But no, he said, put it into long chain fat. So it makes it a lot easier than doing a rectal suppository. So I think I've got the ideal way to do it. I put a little butter, maybe a teaspoon of butter, mm-hmm. and I use the DHA and pregnenolone, mm-hmm. and I put 3 egg yolks, which is another emulsion, because it's got lecithin. How much better can you have it emulsified? You can't. That's the pity. The butter and egg yolks.
In fact, you don't even need to add the butter because the egg yolk contains a decent amount of long chain fats as well. So you just mix it with that. If you don't want to add more fat, that should be good enough. But yeah, the butter adds to it too. Oh, studies that I can send you later show that combination of precursor hormones such as DHEA, pregnenolone, progesterone, and even testosterone, their effects on the cell are greatly increased when they're combined only with saturated fats, not with the unsaturated ones.
Wow.
So you can get, so especially with testosterone, they were using, they're doing tests on old studies from the, mm-hmm. I think, 40s and 50s. So they were giving like the equivalent of 1/10 of the regular dose of testosterone that would maintain the sexual function of a castrated male animal. Mm-hmm. And when they combine it with palmitic acid, which is found in great amounts in butter, right, then 1/10 of the dose of testosterone was sufficient to actually overshoot the recovery of the animal from the castration procedure. And if you combine it with a palmitic acid in a ratio of 1/10 in favor of the fat. So you can get by with using a much lower doses, which should limit the risk of side effects, especially with things like DHEA and testosterone, and get the exact same effects inside the cell.
Yeah. So I just went on a tangent there. I wanted to thank you, but I also wanted to mention that I've been taking DHA in that format for the way you mentioned it for at least a year and a half. So, and I was still 6 foot and 1/4 inch, right? I gained a half inch after. So it wasn't the DHA I was taking that. I think it's pretty extraordinary. And just to extend the bone broth, I want to talk about two things. The bone broth is also useful for healing the gut.
Yes.
No
absolutely.
Question about it.
Yep.
No question about it. So that is one of the, I think if you, in my mind, I'm such an advocate for bone broth now that I don't think you can be optimally healthy without it. Yep. I know what it's done for my own life.
Older studies, at least 100 years old, any kind of digestive ailment, especially bleeding ulcers, mm-hmm. the treatment for that was 3 days, 100 grams of collagen each day taken orally, ulcers gone. Inflammatory bowel disease, also gone. Ulcerative colitis, anything, any digestive ailment that basically has been there for a while, collagen was the thing, was basically the go-to. And it was curative, not just maintenance therapy that mm-hmm. you have to take all the time, just a week or just a couple of days, and it was considered the cure.
And because it's these, I'm sure you can categorize, I forget what the term is, but it's these essentially amino acids that don't contribute to decreasing longevity, you know. I think they're grouped into a category, and I just don't recall the name of it. But it's clearly, if you have these amino acids concentrations that are collagen, you are going to add years to your life. There's just no way around it because you're not getting the other amino acids, which are going to shorten your lifespan.
Mm-hmm. Again, direct study, you can mimic the effects of either cysteine or tryptophan or methionine depletion, which are known to extend lifespan when you restrict them. Mm-hmm. You can achieve the exact same lifespan extension by adding 1-2% of collagen in the diet. That was done in mice and rodents, but because it's metabolic, it should translate directly to humans.
That's a small percent. If, assuming your protein, I think it should be closer to 5%. Why?
Yes.
Because typically protein requirements for most people are about the same. It's close to 15%. You shouldn't eat more than 50% of food is protein. That's just over excess. And yep. certainly more than 10. So somewhere in that range, might be 12, 13, but in that range. So if you say it's 15, just for grins, 1/3 of it should be collagen. That's 5%.
Yeah, but well, no, I mean, I guess they're trying to use the minimum to mimic the effects.
MED,
yeah.
The minimum effective dose.
Exactly.
Yeah, but if you want the optimal dose, it's probably closer to 5.
Close to 5, yeah. 5%. I've tried up to 10% of the protein to be actually collagen. It's fine. In fact, up to 50% of the protein, not the calories. Mm-hmm. 50% of the protein could be collagen. Anything more than that starts to give me nausea, and there are older studies backing that up. I think it's, if you achieve too much tryptophan depletion, and your dopamine rises too much, which is what happens if you deplete tryptophan too much, some of the dopamine agonist drugs on the market, one of the most common side effects is nausea. So that's, I guess that's one way of knowing.
So thank you for helping us understand what the upper limit is. Because like anything, you know, there's a Goldilocks dose. And a lot of people, myself was in that group and still am in many ways, is if a little is good and a lot more, it's got to be better.
Not always.
To know that you don't want to go more than 50% collagen.
Nope.
You do need some, you need some essential amino acids. And you know, speaking of that, glycine is not considered an essential amino acid, but there is no question in my mind, not a micro doubt, that it's it's conditionally essential amino acid. Because most people, you can make glycine, but you can't make enough. You cannot make enough glycine to be optimally healthy. It's like impossible.
There's a proposal now to make both taurine and glycine to be relabeled essential amino acids, because without each one of them, we cannot produce bile acids. And without bile acids, there's no digestion, at least of the fats and the fat soluble nutrients. So that may happen. They may actually become officially essential. Yeah. But I agree with you that I think they're very, very essential, regardless of their official classification.
Yeah, and if you can't afford it and you want to at least take a step in the right direction, then glycine will give you a lot of benefit. But, you know, it's the largest concentration of amino acids in collagen for sure. But it's still not less than optimal.
And one other thing about glycine, not many people realize it, but it's an actual neurotransmitter. Mm-hmm, that's kind of what proves its essentiality. Glycine is the major inhibitory neurotransmitter in the spinal cord, and it's one of the major neurotransmitters that regulates gastrointestinal motility. So without sufficient amounts of glycine in the body, you'll have problems with digestion, even if you don't have an inflamed gastrointestinal tract.
So when I mentioned earlier about the ideal food, and I said that ideally you've got some. I add 2 egg yolks in each of my meals, and then I have a healthy ice cream, which I'm using the Ninja. The Ninja has the Ninja Creamy, actually introduced to me by Ashley. You can make healthy ice cream. My healthy ice cream is our collagen protein powder, 3 tablespoons of maple syrup, 2 egg yolks, and a cup of goat milk.
Nice.
That's the ice cream. And it, you can't really tell the difference between that and store-bought ice cream. It tastes almost identical, except it's healthy. And there's no other additives, so you just make it. And so I have 6 egg yolks a day. But those egg yolks are from actually Ashley's farm, because predators killed all my chickens. For the last 6 months, I haven't had chickens. And I'm probably a week or two away from getting them. I've got 25 chickens and had them for like 6 weeks, and they're still not laying eggs, but they will go shortly.
You can eat as many egg yolks as you want. I'm sure you saw in 2018, FDA quietly reversed its position on dietary cholesterol.
They should have been slapped.
They said it has no implication whatsoever on cardiovascular disease. You can eat all the dietary cholesterol you want. If cholesterol is even involved, it's not the dietary cholesterol that's doing it. So you can eat a ton of eggs.
Yeah. And you want to be egg yolks, at least. I would be careful. I do not eat the egg whites. Because of the tryptophan, and the tryptophan doesn't have the inhibitor from the casein or the calcium, so you're going to get it full. Even though it has 1/4 the amount of tryptophan as milk does, it doesn't matter. You're going to get it. So I do not eat egg whites. I feed that to the chickens.
Yeah, it also binds biotin, so you can get biotin deficiency if you eat too many egg whites.
If it's raw, if it's cooked. Yeah. They deactivate that enzyme, I think. Avidin is the enzyme that's in there that does that. So you have to cook it. If you're ever going to eat whites, do not eat them raw. And now, if you ate the yolk, there's an argument that some say that it doesn't matter because there's more than enough biotin in the egg yolk to compensate for what's bound from the avidin in the egg white.
If you eat whole eggs, you're fine. But a lot of people eat only the egg whites, and I've seen bad reactions.
My trainer, personal trainer for 10 years, that's exactly what he did. I'd give him my whites, you know, because he was foolish enough that the only thing he ate was the whites. It's a decent form of protein, but high muscle mass is not being healthy. You know, you see bodybuilders dropping dead like flies all the time. It's because it's not just muscles. Yeah, you should have muscle mass, but you don't want extreme muscle mass. It's not, you know, it's not the be all and end all. It's just a small component. The food is the key one. So, and it's the major source. Eggs are the major source of choline. You know, it's really, really, really hard to get choline unless you're eating egg yolks. I think it's almost impossible. And there's really no good supplements. Although we're developing one, it's going to be liposomal choline. Mm-hmm. To the best of my knowledge, it does not exist. That I would not take any choline supplement at all. They're not that good. They're not that good. I think liposomal choline will get through, but the others are problematic big time.
People who live in the rural areas or like the more primitive cultures, which turns out they're anything but primitive, if you eat a lot of liver and or brain, it has a decent amount of choline in it.
That's the only other organ, but you know, I don't know. I haven't looked at the numbers because if you eat too much liver, you got a problem too. You have to be really careful with liver. You take a liver. And that's what I give my dog to. I give him some liver pretty much every day. But just not more than an ounce or two. That's it.
Yeah, a lot of iron and also a lot of cysteine and methionine. So you don't want to overdo it.
No. The anti-longevity programs. But you've got to also be careful of what I think, and I suspect you would agree, is the single most pervasive metabolic poison in our food supply.
PUFA.
PUFA. Specifically linoleic acid. Yeah, PUFA.
Yep.
No question about it. So that's why I don't recommend having many egg yolks because of the PUFA. Now, Ashley's eggs are really low. They literally have less than 75 to 80% of the PUFA of a normal egg. So you could have five of her eggs and that would have as much PUFA as one of the other eggs.
The commercial ones. Wow, that's
amazing. If they're free range, organic, it doesn't matter. They're all the commercial feed, except the one that she and her farmers put together. And the one that I use in my home is high in PUFA. In fact, I think mine's even lower than Ashley's. I can't wait to get the eggs measured because all I feed them is sprouted, pressure cooked, split peas, and egg whites, which has no, and rice. And there's like very little, virtually no linoleic acid in there. And you can do that with hogs too. But one of the tricks for hogs, I don't know if you know it, is when you have milk and you make butter, you what you get out on the other end is like skim milk.
Yeah.
Or no fat milk. I mean, they almost take all the butter out. I mean, all the fat. And that no fat milk is wonderful, wonderful food for hogs. It makes them have the saturated fat they were designed to because it's the other fats in there that cause the problem. So they're essentially it's like we were talking about before on some of your podcasts with the skim milk or no fat milk. I think you even tried it for a while, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great food, but at some point I start getting like a fats, I start craving fat. Uh-huh. If I go on zero fat for too long. So for me, an optimal amount of fat is about 5 to 10% of calories.
Yeah.
Less than that will be better for weight control, but it just feels like something's missing taste-wise.
So sure. Yeah. And you know, I was eating the cheese, just eating it at room temperature. And then I realized I love pizza. I think everyone loves pizza. So I started to melt the cheese in my rice, and boy, that was next level. That was orgasmic almost. When you have hot fat, that's the best.
Yeah.
There's a transition. Yeah. It's
flavors
just
in the fat.
To the next level. This is the difference between cold pizza and hot pizza, right? They're both enjoyable, but you got to be out of your mind if you say the cold pizza tastes better.
Yeah, something about truly like about melted cheese specifically that's really good.
Yeah.
Or cooked bacon. I mean, I know she has a lot of PUFA, but still something about the smell of the fat.
Those pigs were eating non-fat milk.
Yes. Then it will be, you'll have almost none. There's another farmer which contacted me several years ago before Ashley, and he feeds his pigs a lot of butter.
Was that Brad Marshall?
Oh, it could be him. Yeah, it could be him. I mean, because only one person.
Guess who bought his business?
I don't know. Who could
it? Ashley.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, Brad's one of my researchers now. So his passion is doing research like molecular biology. So, and he was doing hog farm, but he couldn't do both. So he sold his business to Ashley.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And she's going to make those hogs, create them, the food supply. So anyway, that's my update for you. So I think we should have you share your data on the studies you're doing with the mice.
Yes. Yes. I'm doing some follow-up studies. If you can wait a week or two, I'll have better news than what I expected.
Okay.
What I got with the first one. And it's really interesting. Basically, the vitamins by themselves did something, but not enough. The aspirin by itself did something, but not enough.
Which vitamins were you using?
B1, B3, and B7, which is biotin. And for every single one of these, there are a lot of studies historically going back almost 100 years that they're involved in the cancer metabolism and the Warburg effect and whatnot.
Well, where is B1? It's in the ETC?
So B1 is the cofactor for pyruvate dehydrogenase. No
B1. Oh, that's where it's at. So yep. It's pre-ETC. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. And okay. Also, turn out B1 has a direct inhibitory effect on something called PDK, pyruvate dehydrogenase kinase, which is the inhibitor of PDH. Yeah. So not only it increases PDH, it inhibits the thing that inhibits PDH.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we have niacinamide, which converts it to NAD+. So NAD+ to the NADH ratio, another controlling factor for pyruvate dehydrogenase. NAD+ inhibits lipolysis, so you have less supply of fat to the cancer cells. And you have biotin, which a lot of people say, well, why did you choose biotin? Several studies, very interesting ones with humans. The first one was a couple of years ago with primary progressive multiple sclerosis, really nasty condition. Within 5 years, these people in wheelchairs, and they don't survive for much longer afterwards. 300 milligrams of biotin, which is a very, very large dose, considering that 1 milligram is usually what you find in most supplements, stopped the progression of primary progressive multiple sclerosis. The researchers were just, their jaws dropped. And the proposed mechanism was dramatic improvement in mitochondrial function. And then another study came out after the multiple sclerosis with Huntington disease, also with humans, smaller one, I think it was 5 or 10 people, also showing arrest of the progression of the disease. And then I looked at some of the older studies that were in vitro showed that if you add biotin to cell cultures, you dramatically increase the production of carbon dioxide, which to me said, oh, must be doing something to the Krebs cycle, just increasing, the throughput to the Krebs cycle, which is part of the mitochondrial metabolism. So just threw it out. First, I started with thiamine by itself, B1, had an effect, not strong enough. Then I added B3, stronger effect, but it just stopped the tumor.
Was it
but
B3, niacin or niacinamide?
Niacinamide. Okay. I have not tried niacin.
Okay, niacinamide, yeah.
Yes. And then added biotin, and the combination of the three actually fully stopped the tumor growth. But it didn't make the tumor regress. So I said, okay, what else can we do?
What tumor model were you using?
It's called a JEKO-1, JEKO-1 cell line. It's a human, I'm emphasizing human, mental cell lymphoma.
Okay.
Basically a tumor that at least when transplanted on immunocompromised animals has 100% lethality and 0% regression with either treatment or spontaneous. So so the nastiest thing you can find at the lab head, I said, well, let's start with that. My daughter used to tell me when she was a baby, she said, Daddy, if you want to learn how to love, you got to practice on somebody you really hate. So I said, well, let's try this in cancer.
Very wise child. Very wise.
Yeah, thank you. So I said, let's try something really lethal, because if it works on that one, maybe it'll work on the other less dangerous ones.
Yeah.
So the vitamins worked, but did not get rid of it. So I said, what else can be done? And then I added aspirin at a human equivalent dose of about 1.5 grams a day. High, but not nearly as high as what people take for rheumatoid arthritis. They take 4, 8, 6 grams,
That's 4 aspirin a day, isn't it?
Yeah, so it should be doable, right? I mean, it's not at the toxic level. It's high, but it shouldn't be causing toxicity. Mm-hmm. And that experiment, 3 mice, all of them, the tumors regressed fully. And then we kept the mice alive after the tumor disappeared to see if there'll be any recurrence. One of them looked like there may be a recurrence, but then after a few days disappeared. And after 70 days, normally the study lasts about 2 weeks because the tumor is so lethal. After 70 days, 2.5 months later, all 3 mice completely tumor disappeared, did not come back. And now we're doing follow-up there is an analog of aspirin known as 2,6-dihydroxybenzoic acid, much stronger acid, and much more lipophilic. So I thought, one of Ray's main theories was that the reason cancer cells, because they're metabolically dysfunctional, we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
And typically a cell like that commits apoptosis. But in order to commit apoptosis, that mechanism is controlled almost entirely by the intracellular pH. And in order for apoptosis to occur, it needs to be in the acidic range, but the cancer cells are alkaline due to exporting lactate and hydrogen ions. So if anything can drop the intracellular pH, those cancer cells, because they're deranged, should actually disappear by themselves. And one of Pete's suggestions at the time was, why don't you use the drug acetazolamide, which is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, increases carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is acidic, right? And then that should allow cancer cells to commit apoptosis. There are some studies in vitro and in vivo showing that acetazolamide may work, but it didn't really cure the tumors. It was a slower growth, partial regression, but it showed that the idea was on the right track. So I said, let's find something that's much more acidic than carbon dioxide. And that is this 2,6-dihydroxybenzoic acid, which is just one extra hydroxyl group on top of aspirin, salicylic acid, really, which is 2-hydroxybenzoic acid. And then this thing is about 10 times more potent than aspirin, and it was used in the 60s and 70s to treat rheumatoid arthritis, and dose is 10 times lower than aspirin. So if you're taking 8 grams of aspirin daily, 800 milligrams of this thing completely disappear any symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis in 24 hours. I can send you the studies. But they did not like the fact that it changed the electrolyte balance in humans. They, at the time, they thought this is unacceptable toxicity, so it never really gained traction. So I added that, and now instead of aspirin, we're using this in addition with the vitamins. Much lower, 10 times lower than the aspirin. So okay. If the aspirin was 1.5 grams daily, this is 150 milligrams daily for human, almost nothing.
Okay.
Wow. And two of the tumors already fully regressed 1 week after starting the follow-up study.
Wow. Is this drug, aspirin analog, available? Or is it?
It's freely available, no patent, nothing on it. Quite a few studies back in the day, but really a very generic molecule.
Just from the chemical companies? I mean, it's not commercial.
Yeah, Sigma. Available for any company you can imagine, dirt cheap too. Cheaper than aspirin.
Oh, my God.
That's so we'll crazy. See.
You have to send me a study on that, okay?
I'll send you a screenshot.
That's amazing. So where are you getting this published?
We'll see if they'll accept it. The group that I started back in Bulgaria, they're a bunch of chemists, so they have, unlike me, they have the credentials to publish. When I approach journals, the first question is, you're an IT guy, what the hell are you trying to do with trying to publish in a biochemical journal? So anyway, so they'll try to approach some journals.
If you want, as an author, I can swing it through some of the journals because I get invites to write articles for journals all the time.
So what I'm trying to do is, after we have proof of concept, then we're going to do a real follow-up study, which means there's a group that will have standard of care treatment, more animals, because right now, to keep the cost low, I'm doing 3 per group, but I want at least 5, because that's what they accept for statistical significance. And then I want to try on several different tumor models, both native to the mice and also several other human ones. Now, at least my argument is that, look, if this is working on, let's say, 5 or 6 different tumor models, some of them native to the mice, which means the mice are not immunocompromised. Some of them on human tumors, xenograft models, which means the mice are immunocompromised. There must be some generic mechanism underneath that's really applying to all of these cases. And then I'll present the metabolic mechanism. Because right now the attacks that I'm getting, at least the criticisms, have been, okay, these mice are immunocompromised. Basically, how do you know that you're not simply killing the tumor faster than you're killing the mouse? I said, well, we kept the mice alive. They didn't die. And without treatment, the tumor never regressed. They say, well, it's a human tumor on a transplanted on a mouse. It doesn't really apply directly to humans. You really need a human study, which there are 3 case studies, which I maybe will see. Cancer patients have expressed interest. We'll see what happens. But if it works on a native tumor model and a human tumor model, I think it will get more attention in terms of publication. It'll be less attackable as a fluke, as a fact.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting. So you had mentioned earlier that most of the cancer cells are alkaline.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked, I mean, you and Brad Marshall seem to be like the two people who understand reductive stress the best that I know. Maybe Peter and hyperlipid is up there too. But do you think that the reductive stress, the surplus of electrons essentially in these cells, contributes to their alkalinity?
Yeah, because the cell tries to get rid of the hydrogen ions, which are basically the excess electrons. And the way it does this is by exporting a hydrogen ion and a lactate molecule. And basically by exporting the extra lactate plus the hydrogen ions, you get extracellular acidity, but intracellular alkalinity.
That's the mechanism.
Yeah. So healthy cell, because it's producing carbon dioxide, intracellularly, a healthy cell should be slightly acidic.
Yeah.
And any kind of decline in the carbon dioxide production, you're going to get alkalinity, with cancer being the very, you know, the very other side of the extreme. So since the cancer cell is already deranged, you know, it does have a mechanism to try to kill itself before killing you. But in order for that mechanism to kick in, it seems to be controlled by pH. I don't know the exact mechanism why that was proposed by Ray, and he suggested the acetazolamide drug. And now by adding this much stronger acid, aspirin is also an acid, but not nearly as strong as this 2,6-dihydroxy analog, seems to be confirming it, because the tumor is regressing faster than the group that is using the aspirin and the vitamins. So I'm having several groups. The group that worked on the first experiment, which is the 3 vitamins plus aspirin, and now there's a group with the vitamins and the more acidic analog, and that curve of regression is much steeper than the one with the aspirin.
So, curiosity question, did you control for the diet? So are these animals all getting traditional rat chow?
Yep, all of them. All of them getting
high linoleic acid on top of this.
Exactly.
They're mitochondrially metabolically poisoned.
Curious experiment, which I performed about a year ago. I said, let's see if we can do it only with diet. So I asked them, okay, try to put the mice on a completely fat-free diet and basically have them eat the fat-free diet for 2 weeks before you try to implant the tumor.
Yeah.
So they did that. And the reason I said it is that I'm expecting for the animals to get into fatty acid, essential fatty acid deficiency if they eat it. Yeah. They could not implant the tumors. The lab said the mice are completely resistant to tumor implantation if they eat a fat-free diet for 2 weeks, which confirms another one of Ray's statements that if you're essentially fatty acid deficient, you shouldn't be developing cancer. It's almost impossible for a cancer to take over.
They require fat for fuel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And especially the polyunsaturated fats, they seem to have preference for them.
Yeah.
So if you can remove those, and it looks like 2 weeks of that for the mice, because they have much faster metabolism than us, that was enough to trigger essential fatty acid deficiency. No negative symptoms of the essential fatty acid deficiency. I know the burst study said, scaly skin, cracked skin, loss of weight. None of that happened in those mice. Maybe it was only 2 weeks. But then they destroyed the immune system. I think they irradiate the thymus or completely remove it. And then you try to inject the tumor cells. And normally, on a normal diet, it happens in one day.
Mm-hmm.
This time, they tried 11 times, different times or different days, to inject the mice with the human tumor cells. The tumor did not form. So the experiment basically demonstrated that if you're essentially fatty acid deficient and don't yet have cancer, in all likelihood, you will never have it.
Yeah. Well, we're not advocating that. You know, It's a curiosity, but it's a powerful demonstration of the critical importance of that. And also, it really dramatically contradicts some well-intentioned individuals. Like I can think of Thomas Seyfried on Boston College, who's wrote the book, The Metabolic Theory of Cancer, which promotes a high-fat diet, the exact opposite.
Yep.
And has gotten some interesting results in glioblastoma models. But what would he get if he had a no-fat diet and this aspirin analog that's 10 times more potent? You know,
I'm eternally grateful to Dr. Siegfried. He's a Nobel laureate, right?
No, I don't think so.
Well, isn't he the one that he took a cancer cell, took out the mutated nucleus, put in a healthy cell,
and showed
there's no cancer? Yeah. Oh, okay.
That wasn't right. Seyfried. Seyfried cites his work quite a bit, but that's another researcher.
Okay.
It's not Seyfried. Yeah.
But that, to me, conclusively proves that cancer is a metabolic disease. You can take a completely mutated nucleus, completely deranged, put in a healthy cell to mitochondria, cell behaves as normal. There's no cancer.
Yeah.
But you take a cancerous mitochondria from a cancerous cell and you put in a healthy cell, then you get a cancer cell.
That's the proof is in the pudding. But just think if he understood reductive stress and implemented these strategies, I mean, or even seeking to address the fundamental cause, which is linoleic acid and a radical reduction of mitochondrial function. Yeah, it is the mitochondria for sure. There's no question. That's the core, the absolute core of all diseases is the mitochondria. And the strategy to improve health and life extension, everything is all directed at the mitochondria. And we're in the process of acquiring technology, a license on a technology that, you know what the gold standard for measuring mitochondrial function is?
I mean, I was going to say a capnometer, but it's probably not.
Oh, no. It's a seahorse.
Okay.
You ever heard of the seahorse before? Okay, nope. Look it up. You'll love it because it's what's done in all the research. They actually, this the single gold standard for mitochondrial function. Problem is, it's very pricey. It takes a few thousand dollars to test because it's cumbersome. They haven't figured out a way to preserve the sample. They have to do each one individually, and it's a nightmare. So there's some new technology that suggests you can freeze the samples and still preserve the quality of the mitochondria and measure it when you do the test and batch them and reduce the cost by maybe 100-fold. So that's the intention. And we're also, in my clinic, we're going to use that test and we're going to use indirect correlates of NAD plus.
Okay.
NAD plus is a nightmare to measure. We've had discussions on this.
And it's unstable, very difficult to measure. Yeah.
It's almost impossible. It really is almost impossible. There's only a few labs in the world can do it accurately. I mean, I just shudder to think all these studies that are published on NAD precursors using these supplements. I just don't believe their data because how they can't measure NAD plus. It really is. It's really hard. So what we discussed, and I think we discussed in one of our previous podcasts is in interviews, is that these redox pairs like acetoacetate, BHB, and lactate and pyruvate, and then the oxidized and reduced forms of glutathione. Yep. If you can measure those, you got a good idea what your NAD levels indirect really probably correlate well into the high 90%.
Yep. And it much more better than a direct measurement of the NAD plus to the NADH.
I think so. Do you agree?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because the measurement, even in the cytosol, is very different, is very difficult, or in the blood as well. But mitochondrial NAD plus to NADH, impossible. I don't know of anybody who's actually claimed to measure it reliably.
Yeah. And so the way to do it is to measure acetoacetate and beta hydroxybutyrate. And that is almost the same ratio as NAD plus NADH, which is what you want.
Mitochondrially produced, and because one of them is the oxidized, the other one the reduced pair, they should directly mimic the NAD plus to the NADH ratio.
There's no question that if you have a good mitochondrial function and a surplus of NAD plus, the likelihood of you suffering any disease is pretty remote because you're going to have more than enough cellular energy to compensate for almost anything that the life can throw at you. Mm-hmm.
Recently showed that the naked mole rat, which lives 40 years, the longest of any, I think, rodent of that size, one of the key distinguishing characteristics was, aside from the high levels of CO2 in the burrow, is that it biochemically had very high levels of NAD plus to the NADH in the blood, and also very high levels of DHEA and pregnenolone.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, NAD plus is the key. So we're going to measure that in our lab, in our clinic. It's not really commercially available anywhere. I think Quest may offer it, but it's like thousands of dollars to do it and not easy to do. We're going to do it in our labs. It's not that expensive to do. We get the test kits for each assay, and you need a special fluorometric plate reader, and we can do it. So I might be buying a number of these instruments, and we'll measure it all over. I'm going to invite you because you were kind enough to measure my minerals in my nails.
And your hormones were great.
Steroids. I'm sorry?
Yes, your steroids were great. I think the reason you did not benefit, you did not grow your height from DHEA, was that your DHEA was already at optimal levels.
I was using for many years the rectal spice. So they do work, but it's so much easier to egg yolks and butter. Oh. Yep.
And tastier, right?
Oh, much tastier. And you know, sticking something up your butt is not pleasure. I mean, I'm at all. Although I am playing with intrarectal CO2. We just have to get an IRB for it going up and running before we can promote it regularly and prove the safety, because no one's proved the safety at all. So we have to prove it. But I think that may be the single best biohack ever invented. I mean, because CO2 is the bomb, absolute bomb. And it literally is sort of the magic that will reverse the microbiome back to health. Because when you have a surplus of CO2, that's one of the nutrients that gets diminished when you aren't able to have enough cellular energy. CO2 levels go down. So if you supply it artificially, exogenously, you can sort of bypass that mitochondrial deficiency until you're able to get it back up. And that takes a while because you got to get the mitochondrial poison out of your system. And that takes years. So you're not going to see improvement for months of doing that. It just takes time. It takes time. So,
well, a lot of projects on your plate.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I'm so excited. And I'm so appreciative of all your kindness and help and really providing me with motivation to pursue this. Oh, we got the light issue, the timeout. All right. So anything else you'd like to dive into?
I think everything's fine. I mean, so far, if we can avoid World War III, I think we'll be fine.
Yeah, I don't know that we're going to hit the World War III, but there'll be some. This fall is
going to be wild, right?
A lot of things are on table this fall. Yeah. I just hope we don't lose everything. But this could be, it's going to be a problem anyway around it. But it's just, and I'm not promoting any political party, but the potential for devastation is extraordinary.
Yeah, I just pray that people don't get at each other's throats, which is really the most dangerous thing. And right now, they're certainly, by speaking to both sides, they're just, you know, really angry.
This fall is going to be very precarious. You know, it may dictate whether I stay in this country or not. Oh, really? I mean, it's just
I agree.
Syrian exit strategy is just.
Well, all the more reason for you and I to continue pumping out good information, give people hope, right? Because that's what keeps people grounded.
Yeah.
You know, if they get nihilistic and start thinking that nothing matters, I'm going to get cancer and die, so nothing really matters, then they're more prone to violence.
Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, that's the beauty of this work. If you're close to death, and many people are, you know, at some point we're all going to leave this life. But if you're a few weeks away, the likelihood of recovery is pretty low because you need a certain level of biological energy to catalyze the recovery. And below a certain level, you just don't have it. You know, we might have technology in the future, but right now it's not really there. But that's for most, that's pretty far gone. I mean, I think within a month, someone's still alive in a month, unless they've taken poison. And what is the most common poison aside from linoleic acid that people take that's used therapeutically that kills people?
Oh, radiation and chemotherapy.
Yeah, that's it. You knew it. Yeah. Of course you knew it. Yeah. If you're listening to this, maybe this will save your life or someone you love. Cancer is a big cause of death. It's trending towards the number one cause of death. If you become afraid and choose to believe the experts that are using fear to motivate you to make the choice of the purchase, they're very expensive drugs that sell sometimes more than $100,000 a month, at which they get a significant part of that profit. Yes, oncologists do earn a profit, a percentage of the dangerous drugs that they're using to kill you. And if you choose that, you know, you may recover after the first round, but most likely after that, the more you take and the longer it's been before you get back on treating the cause, you've essentially you swallowed your poison, your death. That's like taking cyanide and with no methylene blue in sight, you know,
exactly.
You're going to die. We've seen this so many times. I mean, I think Zelenko, are you familiar with the Zelenko protocol for COVID? Yeah. He was confused too. I mean, he just embraced natural medicine after he was diagnosed with this very rare pulmonary artery sarcoma, I think. And died from it because he took multiple rounds of chemo. I mean, when I was helping him navigate that, he asked me to mentor him in doing this. And it was too late, though. It just was too late. And he was a smart guy and was willing to do anything. But once you swallow that chemo poison, game's over. You know, I mean, unless you just did it once and you woke up. You can get by maybe with one round. But after that, you're just not going to recover.
Or if it's a localized tumor, maybe you can get away with the surgery or something.
Once
it becomes systemic, then it's like you're just adding more signal to the system that things are bad. It's cytotoxic therapy. That's why it's called that way.
Did you do that with your RAS? Did you test him with chemo?
No. Well, that will be the standard of care treatment, which we'll be following up, and we'll be compared to this one. We've already determined that the current treatment is not cytotoxic. So how does it make the tumor disappear? I've asked several of the oncologists that are communicating with me on Twitter. They're saying, well, maybe it's because the mice are immunocompromised. I said, well, that shouldn't affect the tumor. But we don't know. Until you compare it to the standard of care treatment, we don't want to comment. So,
standard of care, they'll die for sure. But I'm wondering if the standard of care treatment, it would be an interesting arm is to do the standard of care treatment and, you know, maybe treat them in a month and 2 months and give them and see if you can recover them and see, maybe just do it with 1 month and then see if you can reverse it still. You know, what is the threshold of insult that you have before you come in and rescue them before they're dead, right? Yep.
So I mean, after, if we see that the standard of care treatment is about to die, we'll stop them and switch them over to the aspirin and vitamin therapy.
That?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, when do you do that crossover?
I'm saying now that will be the comparison. If we start seeing that the chemotherapy group is going to die, well, it's going to die anyway, so we might as well do a crossover. We're going to give the chemotherapy group the aspirin, and then we're going to give the aspirin group the chemotherapy. And if we start seeing the reversal of the curves, then I think it's game over.
that could be as epic a study as the mitochondrial one, the transplant study that you just cited earlier. Yeah, it's pretty comparable, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it would be hard to argue that chemotherapy is good and that actually cytotoxicity is the way to go, because almost all of the therapies currently on the market, they're still all about killing the alien cancer cell.
So are you going to write up a protocol for humans to take this?
Yeah, because there's a pretty direct conversion formula. There's some minor things that need to be worked out, because the formula that converts a mouse dose to a human one is based on body surface area metabolism. So there are minor differences between individuals of each species. But the pharmacokinetics are pretty well established for all of these chemicals because they're pretty well known, except maybe for the acidic analog of aspirin. Mm-hmm. But there's some data on that too from the older studies with the humans.
So I assume, because you're invested in doing the studies, you reviewed the literature quite aggressively, that this is probably the most potent metabolic intervention you can think of.
Yes, short of doing T3, for which there are studies with cancer, older studies. Okay. And there are several studies of remarkable recovery from metastatic terminal cancer by giving natural desiccated thyroid at really high doses, 15 to 20 grains daily. But it's still not cytotoxic. And the explanation, even of the people at the time, was that since it was in the 50s and 60s, they still remember Warburg. And they said, Mr. Warburg is probably right. The cancer should be treated with pro-metabolic therapy and not anti-metabolic therapy.
Right. The reason I'm so curious is because I didn't really share this publicly, but I kind of alluded to the fact that I'm starting a Mercola Health Clinic in South Florida. And yes, we're going to have an outpatient clinic, but we're also building a restaurant.
Excellent.
And we're also building a hotel.
Nice.
And guess what?
With CO2 therapy.
guess what two floors of the hotel are?
I was going to say, with CO2 outpatient therapy, probably CO2.
Although that's separate. That's not in the hotel. We get that's in the clinic, actually. We teach people to do CO2. And then we'll have a fitness center, too. It's going to be a whole complex. We'll start building, hopefully, later this year. We got to get the zoning approval, so we have to get renderings first. But it probably will be the second biggest attraction in the state of Florida after Disney World.
I would say no, not second, number one. I think Disney already messed up significantly.
Yeah, they did. But it's going to be quite the tourist attraction for sure. Yeah. And we'll be seeing people from all over the world. I'm really looking forward to it. But as we get in, that's not going to be, it's going to take us a year, year and a half to build that. So it's going to be a while, but I'm definitely going to have to pick your brain for cancer therapies. Georgie, it's been such a pleasure. I can't thank you enough for all the help you've provided in the past and then sharing a lot more interesting tips today. So if people want to learn more about your work, I think you've got a blog and you've got a Twitter feed, which is the same name. It's this HeyDut. I think it's HeyDut.
Yes.
H-A-I-D-U-T. And folks, this blog is free. It's wonderful. Anytime I have an RSS feed, so I know when there's a drop. I don't have to go every day and see it. And I would recommend that you search my website, because all my old articles are up now, and you just look up for RSS feeds. And I wrote a nice big article on how you can get RSS feeds, and you can put Georgie as one of your feeds on there. You'll know when he drops a new one. But if I want to question something, the topic, and I want to find out some good stuff about it, I go to Georgie's site first and type in what I want to learn about, because he's usually found lots of great pearls.
Thank you.
So you're crazy enough to do this. It's free. He's doing this out of his generosity of his heart. Doesn't charge for it. You don't have to pay for it. It's there. So that's one. And then you got a Twitter feed too, right? It's @HeyDut.
Yes. Twitter or xnow.com, /HeyDut. I follow what is the principle? If you've been given knowledge freely, freely you should give as well. I think it's in the Bible, but I think it applies to everybody.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you're doing a great job, and I can't thank you enough for all that you have done, especially helping me and nurturing me along and being patient and kind and helping me understand some basic principles I was profoundly ignorant about. So
thank you. Likewise. I mean, I think it will be a great benefit to humanity. So let's just keep flying forward.
Yeah.
And pray for peace.
I hope so. Peace for sure. Not only abroad, but internally, because the fall could be pretty devastating.
Yep.
Okay. All right. You take care.
Thank you, Dr. Mercola. We'll stay in touch.